Maybe you've heard about the woman who was married four times. The first time she married a banker, the second time she married an actor, third time she married a physician, and the fourth time she married an undertaker. And when somebody asked her why she married those particular people, well, she said, you know, one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, and four to go. Well, this morning I want to help you to get ready to go. We've talked about why you should do premarital counseling, and now today I want to talk about the what and how of premarital counseling. In other words, I want to talk to you about the methodology or process by which the goals of premarital counseling, which we mentioned, may be accomplished. What I'm going to be sharing with you will be a description of what I do and how I do it. And when I do this, I'm not suggesting that my way is the only way, nor am I suggesting that my way is even the best way. But what I'm suggesting is that it's my way. And in this regard, I do it my way. And I've been developing a program for premarital counseling over the last 26 years in which I've been in the ministry. If you like what I do, take it and use it. If you don't like it in its entirety, then adapt it, change it, or come up with a method of your own that's better than mine. Now, first of all, I want to say something about the way that I set up the counseling process. When doing premarital counseling, I usually plan to meet with the couple for 12 or 13 sessions before the wedding and for at least two or three sessions during the first year after the wedding. Ideally, some of this counseling that I would do before the wedding should be done before the couple even becomes engaged. I think that couples who are beginning to think about marriage ought to be encouraged to begin counseling before a firm decision to get married is made. In other words, I think it's a wise practice for couples who are thinking about engagement to get involved in counseling before they even get engaged. If this practice were followed, one of two things might occur. For one thing, they might discover that they are really ready for marriage, and so they would go ahead and get engaged with some confidence. Or they might discover in the process of pre-engagement counseling that they're not prepared for the responsibilities of marriage and decide not to go ahead with the engagement or the marriage at this time. This would prevent them from putting themselves in a difficult situation of breaking up the engagement, or because of embarrassment or the difficulty of breaking the engagement, going ahead and getting married when they really shouldn't be getting married at this particular time. Now, to me, that's the ideal. I don't think that it's an ideal that can be required, but I do think it ought to be encouraged in our churches. Presently, I have two sons who are married. Well, before either of my sons got married, we sort of insisted that before they got engaged, in fact, that they go for pre-engagement counseling. And they went through this period of pre-engagement counseling to sort out some things, to evaluate some things, and then only after the counselor judged that they were really ready for engagement and marriage, did they go ahead and get engaged. And I encourage that particular practice for all of Christians who are looking forward to marriage. But whether you do some of the premarital counseling before engagement or all of it after engagement, I'd recommend that you think in terms of 12 or 13 sessions before the wedding and at least three sessions during the first year of marriage. In some instances, you may find that you don't need to meet with them that often. That is, you don't need to meet with them 12 or 13 sessions. In other cases, I have found that I had to meet with them more than 12 or 13 sessions to get them ready for marriage. Now, these 12 or 13 pre-wedding sessions may be held on a weekly basis or a bi-weekly basis if there's plenty of time before the wedding. And I think that this ought to be spread in the church, that you don't just slip into marriage that quickly. And once the news gets out and couples begin to realize that this is the process that you go through, and others who have gone through the process get excited about it, they see the value of it, and it begins to spread, and what you're going to see are improved marriages in your church. The three post-wedding sessions would be conducted 6 weeks after the wedding, 6 months after the wedding, and then 12 months after the wedding. Or if the couple wants to see you, as it has happened with me, if they want to see you before that or more than that, such arrangements can be made. Now, during the 12 or 13 pre-wedding sessions, I usually follow a basic agenda of topics with all couples. Depending upon the individual couple, I will emphasize some topics more than I do others, and depending upon the couple, I emphasize certain topics less, because I discover the couple doesn't need as much emphasis in a particular area. And then, too, depending upon the couple, I emphasize certain aspects of a particular topic more than others, because I discover that this particular couple is weak in one area but strong in another area. In other words, I have a basic agenda that I use, but I don't put people on an assembly line and push them through and they all get exactly the same thing. Now, the basic structure is there, but within the basic structure, there's a lot of adaptation, there's a lot of flexibility, depending upon the individuality of the couple and their needs. Now, here's the basic agenda that I follow. These are the elements that I would include in this course of pre-wedding counseling. First of all, I would want to do a rather thorough investigation of their relationship, its history and its nature. How long have they known one another? How did the relationship begin? What is the nature of the relationship that they have? Secondly, I would want to promote a thorough understanding of themselves and of their prospective partners. I want them to really understand themselves. I was reading a book while I'm here, picked it up in your bookstore, written by a friend of mine, a man who teaches at Westminster and pastors a church in Philadelphia. It's a church that has really taken off in the last few years, a book called Outgrowing the Ingrowing Church. And in this book, Jack Miller, who is 56 or 57 years of age, mentions that it's only been in the last few years that he's really come to know himself, his own heart. It's a growing process of coming to know ourselves. Many of us don't really know ourselves very well. And in premarital counseling, I want to help people to really honestly and realistically look at themselves and look at each other. A third important area that I consider is the meaning of real love. The meaning of real love. Because I am convinced that many Christians don't really understand the meaning of real love. Another book that I picked up in your bookstore and which I finished yesterday had many excellent things in it, but there was a chapter in there on love. And in my estimation, the author, a Christian author, was way off base in terms of what real love is. And that's been my experience as I've read a lot of other books that have been written by Christian psychologists, Christian counselors, and even in some instances, preachers. There's a lot of misunderstanding of the meaning of love. And so One part of the premarital counseling would involve a thorough exploration of the meaning of real love. Another element that I would want to consider is God's concept of marriage. Now, every one of us comes to marriage with a concept of marriage, with an idea of what we think marriage is. And the problem is that since we're different individuals, we often have slightly or very great divergencies in the area of what we conceive marriage to be. And so you have these two great big old rivers that have been running independently coming together. And at the point of confluence, there's turbulence because he has his idea of what marriage should be and she has hers. And they're not even aware that their concepts of marriage are different. They just know that something doesn't seem to fit as much as it ought to fit. And so in many instances, digging beneath that, you'll find that he has one idea of marriage and she has another. He learned his from his parents. She learned hers from her parents. Now, if the two sets of parents are very much alike, if the two home backgrounds are very much alike, then maybe there won't be a great deal of difference. But if the two families were very different, both of them have been influenced. It just has to happen. Yesterday, reading an illustration of the man who one day was writing his name and suddenly looked down and he saw not his handwriting but his father's handwriting. And he said he was really amazed that he wrote just like his father. And, you know, it made him a little insecure to think, what's me and what's my father? And then he used the illustration. He said if a painter were to paint a painting and then paint another painting over the painting, to the naked eye, perhaps you could not see the first painting. But if you had the right kind of X-ray machine or whatever kind of machine that could see through the painting on the top, you would see underneath the top painting the outline of the second painting. And he said, that's the way it is with us and our parents, that our parents have impacted on our lives. And if you had just had the right kind of machine to see through us, you would see behind us a tremendous replica of our parents and the impact that they have had on our lives. And what I'm saying is that happens when two people come into marriage. They picked up differing concepts of marriage from their parents, from the reading, perhaps from a preaching that they've heard. And it's important to help them to come to grips with God's concept of marriage to make sure that both of their concepts are really as godly and biblical as they should be. Another element that I would want to focus on very heavily is the spiritual basis of their marriage. Investigating the reality, investigating the depth of their relationship with Jesus Christ, where the Bible fits into their lives, where Jesus Christ fits into their lives and how they see him in terms of their relationship, their devotional practices, their spiritual convictions, their understanding of the church and the community of the saints and where all this fits into their own lives. And so I would focus on that in at least one session. Another area of consideration would be a careful consideration of the ingredients of effective communication. What is involved in effective communication? I was asked some time ago on a radio talk program, what is the biggest hindrance to marital unity and family success today? Now, that's a question that's very difficult to answer in a definitive way. But from my experience and from what I see in the scriptures also, I don't have time to fill that out, but if I did, I think I could demonstrate from the scriptures what I'm about to say. I believe that one of the greatest hindrances to real marital unity, to becoming that one flesh that God wants us to be, is a failure in the area of communication. Now, communicating involves talking, but it's more than talking. And so I spend at least two sessions focusing on the area of communication before they get married. Another area that I spend a session on is the area of conflict resolution. They're going to have conflicts. They're going to have differences of opinion. And so it's going to be important for them to be able to identify those disagreements, to express those disagreements, and then to know what to do about them. So many times people have unresolved conflicts that go on year after year, proliferate, become more intense, and they one of two things happens then. When I find people who are at the point where they have lost all feeling for one another, we just don't feel anything for one another, there's the unhappy status quo. They're Christians, so they can't get a divorce. They just decide they're going to grin and bear it, and they kind of go their own way and live their own lives. And when I find that happening, in almost every case, I discover that there have been a lot of unresolved conflicts. Unresolved conflicts will kill good feelings. Or you have people who say, well, I know it's not right, but I can't hack it any longer. Certainly God wouldn't want me to go through the rest of my life miserable, and so you have people going out and getting a divorce. And in many instances, what you have there are people who don't know how to face and resolve conflicts, a lot of conflicts which have never been resolved. Another area that I would want to consider is an analysis of the biblical roles of the husband and the wife. And depending on how much they knew about this area from my assessment, I would either spend one session or two sessions. I might combine the husband and wife if I thought they really were on target in this area and talk about it in one session. But if I found that they were very unbiblical in their understanding of the roles of the husband and wife, then I would spend a session on each of these issues. Another area would be a focus on how to view and handle money in a biblical way. Some marriage counselors suggest that the area of finances is the area that couples fight most about, the area in which they have the greatest disagreement. Well, I don't know if that's true, but I do know that a lot of the couples that I've counseled with give me as one of their presentation problems their differences on money. He doesn't care about my views in terms of money, or she doesn't care, and they're squabbling over the financial issue, and so prevent such a situation developing, I would spend some time on the issue of finances. And then the area that most frequently I receive as the reason for marital unhappiness, the area is sexual maladjustment. That's the most frequently mentioned presentation problem that I get in marriage counseling. They're dissatisfied with the sexual area in their lives. And surveys seem to indicate that 50 to 60% of the people who are married are not really happy with the way their sexual adjustment is going. And so knowing that that is usually a big problem, I would want to spend a considerable amount of time discussing with them God's view of sex in the marriage. I also have discovered that the wedding can be a real point of controversy. Unfortunately, that which ought to be a time of blessing and happiness and joy is for some people just a very traumatic experience. The couple will get into fights with one another, the girl gets into fights with her parents, and the couple's upset with what the parents want and some of these other things. And so since I know that, part of the premarital counseling, once the date has been set and it's sure that they're going to get married, would be a thorough discussion of the wedding and all of its details, and then also of the honeymoon. In my marriage counseling experience, I found that many of the couples that I counsel had problems on their honeymoon. And during that time, which is supposed to be a time of bliss, it really wasn't a time of bliss. And so in premarital counseling, I would work through with them very carefully the details of the honeymoon, telling them about some of the problems that they might have, giving suggestions as to what they should do if they have problems on the honeymoon. Now, that's the basic agenda that I think ought to be included in all premarital counseling. And to make sure that these elements are adequately considered, I give them study assignments, which they are to do between each session. These study assignments have been published in the manual, Preparing for Marriage God's Way. This manual includes assignments on all of the elements that I've mentioned and provides the format for every session. There's a leader's guide, a counselor's guide, a teacher's guide, which is also coming out along with the notebook, which is for the couples. And what I have the couples do is to have each couple purchase a manual and then tell them what homework I want them to complete before the next session. They then bring their completed homework with them to each session, and the homework provides the basis for our discussion during the time we spend together. I don't lecture to them. This is a discussion, back and forth time. I ask them questions. I try to lead them to their own conclusions, to their own understanding of the situation. And as the counseling proceeds, and I get to know the couples better, I discern what parts of the homework assignment needs to be emphasized and explored more fully, and which parts need to be investigated less thoroughly. Now, that in general is an overview of how I set up the counseling process. And now I want to become more specific and share some details about how to do the actual counseling. Prior to the first session, I have them get a copy of the study manual that they'll be using. And I tell them that I want them to read all of the introductory material and then follow the instructions for session one and complete all of the assignments before session one. When we meet for the first session, I try to accomplish five primary things. In the first session, I try to accomplish five primary things. First of all, I want to establish a facilitative relationship between me and the couple. I want them to feel comfortable with me, at ease with me, because I'm going to ask them to share some very intimate details about their lives. And so I might share with them some of my own problems, who I am, something about my family, or what have you, something about my own struggles, to make them aware of the fact that I'm not going to sit in judgment on them. I'm not here to be their critic. I'm here to be their helper, and that they can trust me. I want to begin to build that trusting, facilitative relationship, which is so necessary if effective counseling is to be done. Secondly, in the first session, I want to encourage enthusiasm and excitement about the opportunity that premarital counseling provides. I want to get them motivated to see this as a fantastic opportunity for growth in their own personal lives and in their relationship. And so I might ask them to share their thoughts and their feelings about premarital counseling. You'll find some who think they're prepared, they don't need any more. That's all right. You give them the opportunity to say that. You don't chop them down. You don't belittle them for feeling that way. But you probe a little bit more. Well, what could be some of the possible benefits that might come out of premarital counseling? What might you hope to get out of it? And then, having probed their understanding and tried to get them to do some thinking, you would share with them some of the things that I mentioned in the last two sessions, some of the benefits, some of the values of premarital counseling. And then what I would do would also mention my own counseling experience, what I've seen, the difference I've seen between those who have had premarital counseling and those who haven't. I mean, one of the statements that I have heard again and again when I've conducted marriage and family seminars, and people have come up to me and they've said to me, "Oh, I wish I had had this information 40 or 50 years ago. Or I wish I had had this 20 years ago." On the other hand, in the churches that I've pastored, I've seen a qualitative difference between the marriages of younger people who have had premarital counseling and older people who have not had it. Their marriages are much happier, much more unity, and there's just a difference in quality between some of them. I don't want to generalize too much, but I've seen the difference, and I would talk about that and share with them the testimony of others. And then there's research that's been done. There has been a control group of people who have not had premarital counseling, and another group who have had premarital counseling. And there have been longitudinal studies done on these two groups of people. And the research indicates that the couples who have had premarital counseling, number one, they have far less problems, by and large. Number two, they face their problems and they know how to resolve their problems. And over a period of time, their conflicts even become less, whereas, by and large, that is not true in the control group. There is a demonstrable difference that seems to come out of the research studies of these two groups. And I would share that to get them excited about the opportunity, that they wouldn't look on it as a duty or an obligation. Well, I got to do it if I'm going to get married by you. But rather that they'd see this as a fantastic opportunity that they have to improve themselves and their relationship. And then in the first session, I would also want to initially explore and evaluate the issues that were raised by the homework assignment. I would want to evaluate the history of their relationship, and there are homework assignments designed to get them thinking about this, and then they would share it with you. I would want to also investigate the nature and basis of their relationship. Is their relationship really based on Jesus Christ? Is it the sense that Christ is bringing them together? Now, you might say that, but do the facts really line up with that? Or is it physical attraction that brings them together? Is it economic security that brings them together? Is it he's a good catch or she's a good catch? Or is it the physical relationship, the caressing, the hugging? Is that the center of their relationship? I would want to know that because that would influence some of the things that I would do later on in the counseling. I'd also want to investigate initially the strengths and weaknesses of that relationship to see how much perceptivity they have in terms of their strengths and in terms of their weaknesses. And I get concerned if people don't see any weaknesses. There's something wrong. They're being unrealistic or at least not very perceptive if they think they're in heaven now. They're not. I got news for them. There is no perfect relationship this side of heaven. And Jesus said in Revelation 3 that those who say we're rich, increased in, with goods and have need of nothing make him sick. And he says there's something wrong. And that's true in any relationship. I ought to know what the weaknesses are. I've got to identify them because I can't work on them until I've identified them. And then I'd want to investigate the area of marital expectations, what they were expecting out of marriage, what he was expecting in the area of communication, what she was expecting in the area of communication. In the area of sharing, she expects to share everything. He expects to share very little. In the area of privacy, he wants privacy. She wants that togetherness, wants him to hold her hand 24 hours a day. In the area of affection and demonstration of affection out in public or even in the privacy of the home. In the area of friendship, in the area of the time that they spend together, in the area of recreational activities, in the area of spiritual concerns, devotions, the place of the Bible, the place of prayer, praying together, studying together, their involvement in the church. What are their expectations? In the area of decision making, how does he expect the decisions are going to be made, and how does she expect the decisions are going to be made? In the area of finances, investigating his idea of how finances should be handled in the home and her idea. In the area of roles and responsibility, who's going to take out the garbage? Who's going to do the dishes? I mean, these are mundane issues, but these are the little foxes that spoil the vines. And the time to get them out and discuss them and come to some resolution is not after you're married, but before you're married. In the area of sex, what he expects out of sex, what she expects. You're a parenting, a relationship with the parents. How much of a relationship are we going to have with our parents? What role are they going to play in our lives? All of these things ought to be investigated. And in the first session, you can't do it in a thorough way, but at least you can do it in an initial way, and that will, to some degree, influence the way that you counsel in the future. Another area that I want to consider in the first session would be past or present personal problems or eccentricities. Are there secrets that have not been shared? I've seen this happen so frequently, so that I know it's a problem. One guy married his wife owing a lot of money in a particular way. He was embarrassed to tell his fiancée that he owed this money. And after they got married, she discovered that she married a guy who had a lot of debt. And she thought she had been betrayed. He had been disloyal to her. Another woman had had an abortion previously. And as a result of her abortion, she was not able to have children. The husband didn't know about it before marriage. He finds out after marriage. Or maybe there's some peculiar bodily feature that nobody knows about because you're covered up. You know, many of these things, there shouldn't be these surprises after marriage. These should be brought out. Eccentricities and problems from the past or present that ought to be discussed. And so I'd want to initially explore that. Now, the fourth thing that I want to do in the initial session is that I'd want to explain the counseling procedure. And then the last thing would be to assign homework for session two, invite their responses, their questions, their concerns, and then close in prayer. In subsequent sessions, we would try to prepare, repair, and protect the saints by working our way through the basic agenda that I mentioned previously. And to do that, I would use the study forms that are found in Preparing for Marriage God's Way. There are all kinds of inventories here. I just mentioned one. I want to help them to get to know themselves and each other. So I've designed what I call a personal character inventory. And on this personal character inventory, I've listed 30 qualities. And each of the members of the couple are asked to evaluate themselves and their partner on these 30 areas on a scale of 0 to 5. Number 3 is stubborn. Now, let's say you have a person who rates himself at a 4 for being stubborn. He looks at himself and he says, well, I guess I am a pretty stubborn guy. And then he rates his partner at 4 as being stubborn. Well, you've got the grounds, you've got two stubborn people. Now, if they're stubborn about the same thing, it's okay. But if they're stubborn, then you want to investigate. Well, what are you stubborn about? What are you stubborn about? And you see whether you have a situation in which you're going to have a lot of conflicts. Or number 7 is dominant. And let's say you have a fellow who rates himself 5 or 4. That's pretty high in the area of dominance. And he rates his prospective partner at 5 or 4. Well, again, you've got two people who want to be dominant, who want to have their own way. And you've got the context for trouble. Or a little bit later, number 14 is a loner. Let's say that he rates himself as a loner. He's not the extreme of being a loner, but he's pretty high. He likes time alone, and he doesn't like to be around people that much. You know, he'd rather be alone. Now, let's say that she rates herself at 1 for being a loner, which means she wants to be around people all the time. She really likes to have people in the home. And so you've got two people who have two different perspectives in terms of how they want to relate to people. And that's the context in which some severe problems arise. Or number 16 is open. And you have him, he rates himself at 4 as an open person. He's really open. He's willing to share his thoughts, his feelings, what have you. And he rates her at 1. She's very secretive. She won't let him into her life. And that bothers him, that she doesn't trust him enough to let him into her life. Or she gets upset because he's too open. He shares too many things with other people. Or in the area of being affectionate, he rates himself a 1, which means he's not very demonstrable in the area of affection, and she's a 5. Well, you're going to have problems there. Some adjustments are going to have to be made. And what I'm saying is you would go down over this and you would discuss all of these. These would bring out the problems. And then you would be able to work toward some kind of a solution to those problems. And I have all kinds of inventories and forms and Bible studies in this manual which facilitate the diagnosis of the problems and also point the way to resolving the problems. And in the premarital counseling, I would just work my way through them, getting to know the couples, and then dealing with the problems as I saw them emerge. Now, very quickly, I've had many people who have said, well, I see what you're saying, it sounds good, but I just don't have the time to do it. Well, it's good, but I don't know, Tom, man, I've got so many other things to do in the ministry, and now you're asking me to spend 12 or 13 sessions before they get married? What do you think I am? And what I say is, in reality, what you're saying is that premarital counseling is not a priority issue with you. You have time to do other things, but you don't have time to do this. The reason you have time to do those and not this is because you think these are more important. And you're going to have to deal with that as to what you think is more important. The second thing is that in the long run, you're going to save time. If you do the right kind of premarital counseling, in the long run, you're going to save time. Because you're going to find that the people who have had adequate premarital counseling, by and large, are not going to be in your office as often with marital problems. And so in the long run, you're going to save a lot of time. And number three, I'm not saying you have to do it all by yourself. You ought to be training other people. As these people go through premarital counseling, they are good candidates to be trained to counsel others. You got to start someplace, but start building and equipping others so that you, as the pastor, don't have to do all the counseling. You've got others in your church. I'm not saying you have to do it all. All I'm saying is it's got to be done. And more than that, I'm not saying that all of the premarital counseling has to be done one-on-two. Some of it can be done in a group situation, and the manual I've prepared can be used as a teaching guide if you have enough couples who are thinking about marriage. And you put them together, study these issues together, and then after that, you would pull them out and individually spend a few sessions with each of them. You don't have to spend all the time with them, but some time with them. And what you're going to see is God blessing in strengthening marriages. These are the people who are going to support you. You've established a relationship with you. Listen, some of the best friends I have are people I've counseled. I mean, they love me. They support my ministry. God has used me to help them. And listen, friends, in the ministry, we need some supporters. We need people who pray for us. Out there, when people begin to whisper and spread rumors about us, we need others who will shut all that down and say, no, that's not the kind of person he is. I know. I spent time with him. He's a man of God. He loves people. He cares for people. And he's been used of God in my life. So there are a lot of advantages to the couple, to the church, and even to you as a pastor, and ultimately to the glory of God that I see coming from premarital counseling.